Hi, this is John Olson. Thank you for joining us on the National Security This Week podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe so you'll receive a new edition of the podcast every week. Please leave us a review as well and tell others about us. And please contact us with any feedback or opinions you might have by emailing nstw@kymnradio.net. We hope you find the show informative and interesting. Thanks again.
And a dealer.
National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Every Wednesday at 9 a.m., we get together here on KYMN Radio to discuss national security. We'll bring in guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore challenges in American national security. If there are topics you'd like us to cover, please email KYMN Radio, and I'll do my best to find experts who can address your topic. So for today, we're turning again to European security policy challenges. We started that line of discussion a few weeks ago when we had Charlie Salonius-Pasternak, a researcher at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs, on our show, and we'll continue that discussion right now. Our guest this morning is Heather Conley, who's Senior Vice President for Europe, Eurasia, and the Arctic, and the director of the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for International and Strategic Studies. Prior to joining CSIS as a senior fellow and director for Europe in 2009, Conley served 4 years as executive director of the Office of the Chairman of the Board at the American National Red Cross. From 2001 to 2005, she was Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, with responsibilities for U.S. bilateral relations with the countries of Northern and Central Europe. Heather Conley is frequently featured as a foreign policy analyst and Europe expert on CNN, MSNBC, BBC, National Public Radio, and PBS, among many other prominent media outlets. Heather Conley received her Bachelor of Arts in International Studies from West Virginia Wesleyan College, and her Master of Arts in International Relations from the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, or SAIS, or SAIS. And in my opinion, Johns Hopkins SAIS is probably the best international relations program in the nation. So we have a well-trained foreign policy expert with us. So Heather Conley, welcome to National Security This Week.
Well, John, it's great to be here. I'm very biased about SAIS, too, so I fully support your views on that. Thank you so much for that really kind introduction.
So I'm very lucky to have you on with us this week because you have been in incredibly high demand. I mentioned that that you're a frequent guest on NPR and PBS, and I actually saw your interview on the PBS NewsHour on Monday evening, and I heard you on National Public Radio yesterday morning talking about the Biden trip for the NATO summit, the EU economic discussions, and certainly for today's summit between President Biden and Vladimir Putin.
Well, it's been a busy time. Your timing is great. It's impeccable. I jokingly tell my staff, this is like our Super Bowl. The president's visit to the UK, starting with the US-UK, and now ending in Geneva with the summit with President Putin, we're giving our program and our research a good run for its money. So I'm really glad to be with you. Thank you so much.
So if we could, let's just start today with a topic that I think a lot of people are really curious about. We know that the Biden-Putin summit is happening right now as we speak on this radio show. It's happening over in Geneva. What do you think they're talking about this morning?
Well, this is going to be a long meeting. I mean, they're setting it to be somewhere between 4 and 5 hours. Now, part of that is because of translation. They're going to have two meetings in some ways. The first, which is happening right now, is a more intimate setting with President Biden and President Putin, and then their foreign ministers, Secretary of State Tony Blinken, and then Sergei Lavrov of Russia. Then they'll expand that to a broader meeting with five aides on each side. The list is really long, John. I mean, we have a huge issue, a set of issues of contestation with Russia. I mean, just beginning with the last few weeks and these cyber attacks and ransomware, these are Russian criminal groups that are basing these cyber attack from Russian territory. We have certainly seen their impact, the Colonial pipelines. If you're living on the East Coast, you had some run on some gas stations. And we've seen the government-sanctioned espionage attacks, and that was, of course, the whole SolarWinds cyber. So cyber is going to feature very, very predominantly. Arms control, the Russian and American presidents extended by 5 years the New START treaty. That treaty was negotiated in 2010, and it limits the number of nuclear warheads and delivery systems that each country can provide. We have to get very busy on a future arms control negotiation and architecture for a lot of sophisticated weaponry that Russia is certainly putting into place. They're going to talk about climate. They're going to talk about probably Afghanistan, Iran, the Iran nuclear agreement. But we've got such a long list of issues about Russian aggression and behavior, Ukraine, Belarus, inside Russia, Alexei Navalny, the Russian opposition leader who's been jailed, nearly lost his life because of poisoning. So huge issues, not a huge expectation for outcome, quite frankly. President Putin certainly is pocketing this summit. He wants to stand right beside the American president. That parity is so important. We just gave him a huge platform in Geneva. But, you know, President Biden believes that if we do this, if we give him sort of that platform, what we're asking for is predictability. Now, that's a gamble, and we will see if Mr. Putin will take the respect and give us the predictability, and we won't know that for quite some time.
Right. So I want to maybe follow up on some of those topics as we go through our discussion this morning. But I want to jump into our discussions today, starting with the fact that you had service in a very senior leadership position at the Department of State. And I mentioned in the introduction that you were Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, and your focus was on Northern and Central Europe. Can you say more about what that particular position entailed?
Oh, well, thank you. Well, and I have to say, my first day in the office was supposed to be September the 11th, 2001. I came in the next day. And so the job everyone thought I would have changed very dramatically, but it was such a awesome privilege to serve my country at that moment. So my responsibility was for U.S. bilateral relations with 15 countries, so the Nordic countries, the Baltic states, and then Central Europe from Poland all the way to Romania and Bulgaria. The timing of my tenure was so incredible because the United States, with our NATO allies, had to make a really big decision about expanding, enlarging NATO to bring in those three Baltic states, to bring in our Central European colleagues. And I will tell you, 9/11 transformed that conversation. We needed our allies and partners to be with us. Of course, Central Europe, the Baltic states, wanted to demonstrate that they could immediately be of assistance to us in Afghanistan. And it was an extraordinary moment. You know, interestingly about Russia, the Baltic states, obviously a very sensitive issue. There are ethnic Russian populations, particularly within Estonia and Latvia. But that enlargement was, preceded. And today, NATO forces, U.S. forces sitting in Poland are protecting. That's the new front line of freedom. Right. So I felt very, very proud to be part of a larger government effort to bring freedom and prosperity to 100 million people. Europe, but make no mistake about it, you know, those lines are now drawn once again between Russia and NATO, and that's very much what the part of the conversation was at the NATO summit this week in Brussels.
So you were in that senior leadership position. What kind of leadership lessons do you think you learned in those years that you were at State?
Oh, gosh. Thank you. What a wonderful question. So I am so honored that I served under Secretary of State Colin Powell and Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, two individuals who just ooze leadership and management and, you know, it just pounded into us, do the right thing, interagency debates are legend, and there's always a, sort of the Washington game of who's winning. You know, is the Pentagon ascendant? Is the National Security Council ascendant? Is the State Department? How are they doing? You know, we go in there with arguments, with fact. We need to be right, and we may not win the interagency debate, but we are in the scrum. We are in the arena. And as I said, it was such a privilege to serve at that moment for our country, because we needed all of our partners and allies to support the United States in Afghanistan. It was the first time in NATO's history that Article 5, that sacred article where an attack against one ally is an attack against all, was used, never in our wildest dreams. Yeah. When the NATO treaty was signed in 1949, that we ever thought that would come to the aid of the United States. We always thought that would come to the aid of our European NATO allies. It was amazing. Cracking down on terrorist financing, rooting out those terrorists, we had to do that with our allies. And the countries that I had the privilege of looking after and strengthening our bilateral relationship were absolutely essential to America's response to that overwhelming challenge. Was it easy? No. Were there deep divisions? Yes. Are those divisions still being felt today? Yes. But service isn't easy. But we are in it for the long haul, and you have to invest in our allies. They're invested in us, and we know when we are separated from our allies, we can do it alone. We have enormous power, but it's not the place we want to be, because our comparative advantage, America's great strength, is this mighty alliance system that stretches from Europe to Asia. That's our great inheritance, and it can be a challenge. It is expensive, of course, but when that thing works, we can, you know, confront challenges like China, like Russia, like Iran, like North Korea. That's how we solve big problems.
Yeah, I often comment on the education that I had at the Naval War College when we studied Thucydides and the Peloponnesian War. And if you study that, you can understand the importance of alliances and how treating your allies, if you're the superpower, is so very important to your long-term strategic well-being. So let me continue on. So you're at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. What is the overall mission at CSIS?
You know, everyone's like, what is a think tank? What in the world? And one of my colleagues says, you know, sometimes we put the tank in think tanks. So think of that, you know, that big army tank coming your way. So CSIS is a bipartisan institution. So we don't have a political persuasion. In fact, we really pride ourselves that we are sort of like Switzerland. We're neutral territory. We want to bring all the stakeholders together to focus on complex challenges. We came out of an academic background. We were birthed actually as part of Georgetown University in 1962, the heart of the Cold War, and we needed deep and long-term strategic thinking. We sort of parted ways with the academic institution and became a separate entity. But really, the key pillar at CSIS, we are, you know, international security, as our name suggests, is sort of the heart of what we do. But when you look at international, what security means today, we have over 30 programs that look at health security, food security, energy security. Some of our largest programs are looking at economics, trade, prosperity. So really that the security dynamic is so much larger and more complex than just thinking about, again, how many tanks are certainly sitting on a border. So I run a very large regional program, and we look after Europe and Russia and Eurasia, and you know, we span to the Arctic to the Eastern Mediterranean, and we are just one program of 30 plus programs at CSIS. So my day, I testify before briefings, I speak to the media, we do research, we write reports, I speak to a lot of foreign governments, leaders, opinion makers, and we try to think long-term and strategic to make sure the U.S. is prepared for all of our future challenges.
Yeah, and I actually had the J2, the Director of Intelligence for U.S. Indo-Pacific Command, on the show a couple weeks ago, Rear Admiral Mike Studeman, and we actually talked about this importance of sort of reframing what America has to worry about today, and it's really the long-term strategic challenge. We have to shift to a fundamentally different way of thinking about sort of the way the world order is shaping up these days.
Absolutely. Now, the international system is in profound transition right now, and I think that's where what you're seeing, sort of this understanding of the purpose of U.S. leadership globally. How do we use our allies? How do we confront challenges like economic coercion, malign influence? How do you address that? How do you address climate? And it is. It's challenging every national security leader to deal with this complexity, stay focused, stay calm, stay confident. But you know, we have a challenge ahead of us. There is no doubt.
So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1, broadcasting out of Northfield, Minnesota. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Heather Conley, a senior vice president at the Center for International and Strategic Studies. So Heather, let's get into our European security policy discussions, and maybe we can start with this. What do you think are the top three security challenges facing Europe today?
Well, I would certainly say Russia is the most immediate security challenge to the United States and to NATO as well. Again, getting back the long list that President Biden will be raising with President Putin, because in many ways, you know, the Cold War, we had a set of rules. Both sides understood that those rules created some stability. Mm-hmm. We don't have those rules anymore. And you sort of add cyber dimension to that, the information space, which the Russians are certainly trying to dominate. It's really, really tough. Russia is certainly the most significant risk to European security, and as I said, all the issues that they bring with that. So whether it's, you know, nuclear weapons, intermediate range weapons, a lot of testing that they're doing on new weapon systems, the coercion of, you know, NATO allies internally, you know, use of political parties, social media, just trying to enhance division within our countries and between America's allies, that's a massive challenge. The second challenge, I would say, to the long term, and this is more of a security challenge to the United States, but Europe is going to be, is an essential player in this, and that's China. And that's, again, really what President Biden was trying to accomplish, whether that was at the G7 summit, through NATO, and even the U.S.-European Union summit, trying to make sure our European allies understand that China poses a long-term strategic risk to all democracies, and how can we work together to manage that. So that strategic competition, that's how we framed our national security strategy, our interim national security strategy, as well as our upcoming national defense strategy, is that strategic competition. So I think the third issue is really important parcel of addressing the Russia and China challenge set, is that is the stability and the health of our own democracies and our own economic structures. You know, we see Europe's weakness technologically, economically. Unfortunately, they've allowed their defense and military capabilities to atrophy. This is coming home to them, whether it's the migration crisis, whether it's terrorism inside their countries, that they really do need to increase their defense spending. We are seeing good results. They're just slower than what we would hoped, and we've got a long way to go. And I would say equally, about America's consistent and credible approach to its allies. I think the biggest thing that President Biden was trying to do during his sweep to Europe, his trip, was to try to regain the trust of our allies. Mm-hmm. In Europe as well as in Asia, we had a very different approach to allies the last 4 years. As I said, allies are difficult. They are an investment. You have to believe in their value. And we lost faith in that value. And we do some benefit for these alliances. I, I could talk for an hour about all the benefits, but we have to sort of strengthen ourselves, our democracies. We have seen the real challenges here in the United States. We see those similar challenges in Europe. So we have to get strong and healthy ourselves, and that way we're much better, in a much better place to be able to be more competitive with future challenges, whether they come from climate, Russia, China, migration, you name it.
So if I could, I'd like to follow up on a couple of things that you mentioned and offer up a couple of things that hopefully you can sort of clarify for us. So on Russia and on the democratic stability front, we know that Lukashenko in Belarus is sort of, he's basically a Putin puppet at this point, I think is a fair way to say it. What do you think is happening inside Belarus, and what are the ramifications of Lukashenko ordering the Ryanair flight to land and capture his political opponent? I mean, what's the impact there on from a European perspective?
I'm so glad you asked about Belarus. So just to go back just very briefly, so last August 9th, Belarus held a presidential election in which Alexander Lukashenko has been the leader of Belarus since 1994. He's one of the longest-serving leaders, affectionately, I'm joking, known as the last dictator of Europe. And you know, he was very adept at making sure that there was no meaningful opposition. Again, these elections, and I sort of put these in air quotes as I'm telling you about an election, were pretty, you know, usually managed well. But this time, because of his incredibly poor lack of handling the COVID crisis, he didn't believe it, and it was devastating. Standard of living has been going down. There was actually, and his usual tactics to end the Belarusian opposition, throw them in jail or push them out, it didn't work, because the wives of these opposite figures came together, and they actually created a strong force. He could no longer sort of reorganize, if you will, the pieces of the puzzle to reaffirm his legitimacy, and he encountered huge protests. He has cracked down on those protests to a point of basically extinguishing any meaningful opposition. And Mr. Putin came right to his aid, because he fears the same forces in his own country.
Yeah.
So what we're seeing is both Belarus and Russia now employing some of the most repressive tactics that we haven't seen these even during the darkest days of the war, as I said, using military grade nerve agent to kill or disable and harm Russian opposition figures like Alexei Navalny. Mm-hmm. And exactly right, this brazen air hijacking of taking a civilian flight that was going from Athens to Vilnius, Lithuania, basically forcing the pilot to turn around, landing in Belarus in Minsk, and they took off a 26-year-old and his girlfriend, who were blogging and organizing a lot of these protests. It's outrageous. But Mr. Putin is standing by his man, Mr. Lukashenko, and they're you know, unfortunately swapping tips on how to be more repressive. And this is an issue where the U.S. and the European Union working together, sanctioning Belarus, U.S. sanctions, but sanctions only really impact or are meaningful when they really hit the pockets of Mr. Lukashenko. Sanctions aren't too powerful. So this is the conundrum that we are going to face with Russia. We're facing it in Ukraine, this hot war that never ended in 2014, 14,000 killed, 1.5 million displaced. I mean, these are very active conflicts that we tend to ignore. They drop on the agenda, but Russia is using them to certainly make sure there is a clear buffer between Russia and the West. Unfortunately, a lot of people would like a little choice in there, and it's getting harder and harder to suppress the people's desire for change and choice.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the Ukraine situation. I know that the Russians had been massing forces on the Russia-Ukraine border, and that was not looking good for a while there. And I think it's still, I think there's still quite a few Russian forces on the border with Ukraine. So we'll see what happens.
Well, John, that was one of the reasons. That was the impetus in part for the summit in Geneva. Russia mobilized upwards of 110,000 forces on the Ukrainian border and within annexed Crimea. We weren't sure what that was doing, and which is what prompted a lot of phone calls between our chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, as well as his Russian counterpart, General Gerasimov. It was frightening. Now they have removed some of the forces. There's a lot of equipment that's still parked there, and we have a major military Russian military exercise that will happen in the fall called Zapad, and we are about to see a lot of Russian forces in Belarus. They already have a lot of staging and facilities there. And so we need to be very concerned. Again, the outcome of this summit is supposed to be stable and predictable. Well, watching this upcoming Russian military exercise, I'm not entirely sure we're going to see stable and predictable, but we'll keep our eye on it.
Right. Let's shift over to a couple of other issues. You'd mentioned climate change earlier in your discussions. And I know that you are an expert, in fact, on climate-driven impacts to national security. How are the Europeans responding to the impacts of climate change from a security perspective, maybe from an economic perspective as well?
Well, I think we have to give a lot of credit to our European colleagues because they have been very consistent in raising climate change is one of their most pressing national security challenges. And I think we now that this is going to profoundly challenge all countries needing to make sure we have not only the right climate mitigation policies to try to slow down these impacts, but then to begin to reorient our own economies away from fossil fuel dependency. This is a massive shift in the international system, these so-called energy transitions. Europe has been a leader in its ambitions in trying to reach carbon neutrality. They were one of the first to talk about a Green Deal. And so what they're talking about now is putting a price on carbon. This is some concern to U.S. leadership as well. And it's certainly starting to panic the Russian leadership, because if you can imagine imposing a carbon border adjustment tax, a massive export to Europe is Russian oil and gas, as we know from Nord Stream 2, more fossil fuel exports. So that could be really transformative. So any of the energy-producing countries like Russia, like Saudi Arabia, Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, these energy-dependent countries, if we could see a future in the next 10 to 15 years of either a decarbonized economy or a dramatic reduction in fossil fuel use, you are talking about massive transformation of their economies. Just looking at Russia, they speak about the benefits of climate change, particularly in the Arctic, new shipping routes, the Northern Sea Route, new energy production, minerals, fishing. They are always celebrating the benefit, but they are suffering the dramatic costs, permafrost thaw, coastal erosion. Yeah. I mean, their buildings are literally breaking apart, pipelines cracking, fuel storage collapsing, causing catastrophic environmental damage. They're also suffering from the effects, and that impacts all of us because the methane and greenhouse gas emission release from permafrost thaw impacts the world. As the Greenland ice sheet melts, that is sea level rise. And we know the Arctic is warming three times faster than any place on the planet. So while there are economic opportunities to climate, indeed, the challenges are massive as well. So we will see how Russia manages a huge amount of change for a government that only wants to prevent any change from happening. Right. So those two forces are about to collide.
So we also know that climate change has been driving changes to human migration patterns. And over the past number of years, Europe has seen mass migration of refugees from the Middle East and North Africa. And that's not just from the conflicts. That's from the climate change, the heavy weather impacts, drought, really, in much of the food production areas in the Middle East and North Africa. And those migration trends, are they likely to continue? And how do you think those migration trends will impact EU security policy? They've really had to deal with some tough challenges, some tough humanitarian challenges over the past 5-6 years.
Well, you're right, John, and this is where both the United States and Europe understand the impact of migration through conflict, through climate, and poverty. We understand this is a massive national security that we can manage these migration flows to the best of our ability. This is particularly challenging for Europe because they cannot come to agreement on a migration policy. They've certainly tried for the last 6 years, but they have failed. And the southern, again, this sounds familiar, just like in the United States, right. The southern states bear the brunt of the migration challenge. So do southern Europe, Italy, Greece, mm-hmm. Spain. They are receiving migrants across the Mediterranean. Some are using land routes from Turkey through Greece. And what Europe has been trying to do is stop all of that. But then they do have, just as we do on our border, the humanitarian crisis. Right. These are young people, children. You see these devastating pictures of loss of life in the Mediterranean. But there is no political solution, and the politics of migration, again, as we know so well in our own country, feeds the most extreme political voices, which makes government action as well as political stability a little challenging. It certainly impacted Italian politics, which are always rambunctious, but it's a very big issue. It really roils the entire European political spectrum. So this is a massive issue. You'll ask a European, what is their biggest security challenge? I, of course, listed where I thought their greatest security challenges was. The first thing they'll say is migration, and they'll say Africa.
Yeah.
And it's because they know this is a source of great instability to them politically, certainly, but as well instability that could come if they cannot manage their borders well.
Yeah. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Heather Conley, a Senior Vice President at the Center for International and Strategic Studies. So Heather, you mentioned China. So let's turn to the EU policies toward China. We know that President Biden just met with both our NATO allies and the EU nations on Monday and Tuesday, and China figured prominently in those discussions. President Biden was pushing our European partners to put more pressure on China, and our European partners demurred a bit, hoping for greater support from the U.S. to take on Vladimir Putin and Russia. China's Belt and Road Initiative targets Asia as a middle point in the Chinese effort to reach European markets, primarily European markets, by both sea lanes and land routes. And we've seen only minor pushback from the EU lately against China's economic plans. How do you see this situation playing out over the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, you're exactly right. The U.S. has been really working with its allies in the Indo-Pacific and in Europe to help build a more united allied front towards China. And it's been difficult for Europe, quite frankly. Europe is evolving in their policy just as we evolved. I mean, you do have to remember it was just a couple of years ago that the United States was seeing, you know, China as, you know, hopefully a partner that we could manage China's rise in a peaceful way. Well, that's not the case
No.
anymore. And Europe has also been trying to manage a spectrum of Chinese behavior. So the EU's policy is looking at China as a partner, a competitor, and a systemic rival. Well, that covers the landscape, right?
Right.
You've got your bases covered there.
Yeah.
We, of course, are tipping that spectrum much more on the systemic rival part. Europe does not want to get caught between the United States and China. They want to be left out of it, and they want to continue to trade freely with both. That is sort of Europe's perfect
right.
position. That is the world they may want, but that is not the world that they have. And, you know, increasingly, and the tactics were probably a little self-defeating, but I give credit to the Trump administration. They really pressed our allies, and I'm thinking in particular the United Kingdom,
mm-hmm.
That had a policy of a golden era with China. I mean, it was just extraordinary in their attempts to woo Chinese investment in the UK and strengthen that relationship. They have completely done a 180. Of course, the tragic situation we see in Hong Kong, and mm-hmm. China's basically ripping up of the of the basic law that was negotiated with the UK, that has certainly helped and promoted that. But our strongest allies and partners realize China is a risk economically, from an intelligence perspective, and they understand that China's behavior in the South China Sea and violating international maritime norms, it doesn't, you know, that impacts far beyond just the South or the East China Sea. So we see this awakening in Europe, and we are to encourage it. Investment screening, trying to deal with Chinese overcapacity, trying to find alternatives from Huawei and 5G. But it's a work in progress. And I think the important thing to note is that Europe, particularly Germany, you know, the most important European economy, is very reliant on China's market, particularly for their automotive sector.
Right.
And so this is why you saw German Chancellor Angela Merkel, you know, huge reluctance to use those strong words, because the last time the EU placed sanctions on China for their actions in Xinjiang, in the Uyghur human rights violations, China sanctioned EU officials, members of the European Parliament. They really smacked the European Union quite hard, which in turn pretty much stopped the US-EU's comprehensive agreement on investment. So you see that on the one hand, the EU wants this trade relationship. They want market access and reciprocity. But at the same time, they are getting hit with wolf warrior diplomacy,
right,
smacked with sanctions. So
yeah,
in some ways, I think if the United States can work well and collaboratively with our allies to keep moving them in the right direction, slowly, slowly, but get them moving. And then China's behavior, quite frankly, is just helping us, because it's so outrageous that even our European allies are going, okay, wait a minute, that's not what we want. But they don't want to get caught in the middle. And we just have to continue to reinforce they can't sit on the sidelines.
Yeah.
They are a democracy. They ascribe to international law and human rights norms and values. You don't sit on the sideline. You gotta get in the pitch. Let's start working together, and let's hope China can alter its behavior. I don't know if they will, but I think they're more likely to if they see a united front, which is what they're trying to break apart, because they know that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. So let's, if we could, let's shift to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, what we all know as NATO. And I think we're very lucky to have you on the show to sort of discuss this nuance between EU defense policy, European Union defense policy, and current NATO policies, which are not actually totally aligned. They used to be pretty well aligned, but I think as a result of the last 4 years, there's been a shift. Now, how would you frame that? What are the differences right now between EU security or defense policy and NATO mutual alliance treaty policies?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that question. And it's absolutely understandable that everyone's confused, because 22 countries are both members of NATO and of the European Union.
Yeah.
But yet we're talking about very different things. But it's the same forces that will be applied, or the same military capabilities that they have. So I can totally understand why that's confusing to everyone. So let's start with NATO, because that's the most important. NATO is, the premier security alliance for Europe. That is very clear. Yeah, the European Union cannot replicate it,
right.
And why would you? it works, and because the United States is the key pillar, the anchor of that alliance, and you know, its focus is collective security and defense of its 30 members. That's what it does. Now, the NATO summit was interesting because it really, sort of like CSIS, really was starting to expand security and thinking about China, and that's quite new for NATO. But this is where this awesome political military alliance has to stay focused on protecting its members, but at the same time be more politically aware and engaged in all of these cross-cutting security challenges. And certainly for the United States, as China is a growing security strategy, by its nature, NATO is going to be interested and participating in that conversation. Now, the European Union does, though, certainly have a growing role to play in enhancing Europe's security. And it's really in all the soft security stuff. As we have seen over the last 5 to 6 years, with either Russian or Chinese malign influence, disinformation, you know, the infiltration of political parties, this coercive tactics, this is where the European Union plays a massive role. It's their role to work and make sure that EU laws are tight and rigorous, that they don't allow corruption, that they're fighting against these malign forces. So we want them to be a strong pillar. But NATO also needs the EU for something as basic as military mobilization. So for all of you Cold War warriors out there that remember reforger exercises, these were the exercises that US did in the Cold War, which practiced rapidly mobilizing units across Europe. So we're dated version of that we call Defender exercises. And you know what? We have to rely on Europe's commercial infrastructure. It's rails, it's roads, it's ports, it's bridges. That's just the basic stuff. That doesn't fall within NATO. That falls within the EU, the transportation, all the individual member states. So that's why it's really important for NATO, European Union, to work together across a range, that wide range of issues. Now, if the European Union wants to create some defense identity that can help counter terrorist activities in the Sahel, in Africa, try to, you know, enhance border protection. It just can't duplicate what NATO is doing. That is ridiculous, because we're talking about, you know, duplicating the same forces. I'm actually encouraged on the NATO-EU cooperation. I think if we can strengthen what the EU needs to do and does best, and we keep strengthening what NATO does best, and we make sure they're talking to one another, I think we're good. But there's always going to be challenges because of Turkey. Turkey is a member of NATO, but not a member of the European Union. And they like to make sure that the European Union is not going to be able to do too much in defense. And the same thing can be said about the Republic of Cyprus, that is a member of the European Union, but not a member of NATO. So there's always going to be limitations simply because we don't have membership alignment that will allow too much togetherness between NATO and the European Union. But I'm a little less fussed about that. What fusses me is when we hear European leaders talking about strategic autonomy or technological sovereignty. And you know, that's an instinct, again, not getting caught in the crossfire between the United States and Russia or the United States and China, wanting this independent European posture. As I said, I understand the rhetorical value of that, but as I look at European military capabilities and the challenge set we face, why in the world would you go along something separately? You'll be weaker. Why can't you join together with as many countries as possible to be as strong and resilient as possible? And let's hope that the autonomy, the strategic autonomy talk, sort of turns into, you know, more strategic alliances to help meet today's challenges.
Yeah, that political talk of nationalism rarely goes well in the long run.
Exactly, we know that too well as well.
So, Heather Conley, we just have a few minutes left. What else do you think the American listeners here should know about EU and NATO defense policy, or maybe something that we haven't covered much in our discussions today? You did bring up Turkey. I could tell our audience that we could spend an entire hour talking about Turkey and the role that Turkey plays as a crossroads between two critically strategic areas in the world. But Heather, from your perspective, what else do you think
Turkey.
Yeah, what else should we talk about today?
Yeah, two things I'll raise. Turkey, very briefly, of course, President Biden met with his counterpart, Turkish President Erdogan, on the margins of the NATO summit. You know, we have a great deal of concern about the strategic direction of Turkey. Turkey purchased a Russian missile defense system, the S-400s. That is not a smart policy approach for a NATO ally to be buying the equipment of a NATO adversary. Unfortunately, it seemed like there was much of a breakthrough in that that meeting. But Turkey plays an enormously important role, and its foreign and security policy has certainly been quite aggressive regionally, whether that's militarily intervening in Syria, northern Iraq, Libya, most recently Nagorno-Karabakh.
Right.
So we definitely have a big challenge there. The other thing we forgot to mention, and it's both a challenge and an opportunity, is the United Kingdom's departure from the European Union.
Yes.
So I think what we're seeing is a UK that wants to play a greater role in NATO. So keep your eye on, you know, increased British activity, which is most welcome. Their recent integrated review, which was their sort of 10-year security and defense review, now that they have left the European Union and can have that independent policy. I think we saw a lot of goodness in that, you know, keeping a technological edge, being more focused on the North Atlantic, Arctic, as you know, I'm supportive of a more forward-leaning posture there. I think we'll see more activity in the Mediterranean. This is to be welcome, and they're also tilting towards the Indo-Pacific. So, but at the same time, we are seeing, and this played out in the G7, we're seeing real tensions between the United Kingdom and the European Union over Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
And that's not in America's interest, I assure you, to have it's two, you know, very important allies, the UK and, of course, the force of the European Union, fighting each other and not coming together to fight common challenges. So that's something we are keeping a close eye on. Sometimes I feel like I'm going back to the future. We're thinking about Northern Ireland and, you know, we don't want the troubles to return, but we've taken peace for granted a bit in that department. So I'm going to be busy, John. It's, you know, it's whether it's presidential trips or the world, we've got a lot to watch. So I'm glad you're watching it for us on your National Security Podcast.
Well, Heather, we have come to the end of our show, sadly. Thank you for joining us today on National Security This Week.
Thank you for having me. It's been great talking with you.
So, everyone, that closes out this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining me today. I look forward to our show next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. If you have ideas for topics you'd like us to cover, please contact KYMN Radio. Have a fantastic finish to your week, everyone. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.
Frago and Laswell in downtown Northfield is the law office you